Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Arduino sensor development for the utility box that I'm building for Australian schools. Now, let's put a few things in perspective here. This is sort of a follow-up, detailed, advanced podcast, mostly for Michael, who's come back reviewing my research paper on this utility box. So, Batman and various superheroes have a utility belt, which they can access and get out all their superhero things that they don't know is there, but they think this is fantasy idea, which is a utility belt. I'm just saying this is a utility box. The idea, as far from the student's point of view, is that they approach the experiment ahead and putting the sensors in as they build it. So they're thinking ahead of time, and they build it, get the experiments going, then there may be some instruction, some discussion on it, and as it's going all the while, it's recording things as we go along. So that's the sort of generalized concept, and the fact is that the world has changed, and so even if you really want, if you've got a sort of rustic feeling that people should have equipment bespoke, built from a blacksmith's forge rather than mass-produced, and all these types of things, that sort of era, the rustic era of school labs, where you have a standard thermometer and a school book and a stopwatch, and you're looking at things. There's great things similar to a blacksmith. A blacksmith has got a great feel for heat and the forging stuff, but they can only produce so much, and they can only think of building so much. They can sort of think of building, something to hook up to a coach, but they can't think of building something to eventually be part of a super tanker or a spacecraft. You can't get that out of a blacksmith shop. And so similarly, if you give students bespoke old world tools of the old thermometers and stuff like that, they're only going to get a certain amount of... They'll learn skills, and you may value those skills. I don't think they're going to value it. Now, the critical thing which has changed is the overall movement of silicon closer to the sensor, and between the sensor, silicon, and you. Now, what that actually means, ultimately, the temperature sensor is silicon, and each temperature sensor has a serial number, a 64-bit serial number, so 10 bits gets you to 1,000 and 23 or 24, depending if you count zero in there, and that's 10 bits. 20 bits is that squared. So 20 bits is, I suppose, up on a million. And this is, so you're talking about not the particles in the universe type of thing, but more than the stars and the galaxy, that type of number of detectors. So this has really changed it, moreover, the ability to actually move silicon much closer means that you can get much more working at cheaper things. Silicon detector is about a third the cost of a thermometer, and you can get five of them all linked up for no additional cost in working together, and they can all record at the same time. And besides that, the data can be directly logged to a website, and this is the general thing that I was introducing, and I was going through the process of just writing the introduction. Now, the critical thing here is that there is not the aim to be innovative. It's the idea is not to be innovative, that it's to use fairly cheap and reducing cost components which can be pulled apart and used in other places. They're generic components that a school kid could order, and if the teacher doesn't know it, a few parents and stuff like that, and kids themselves can go on the internet with instructables and actually build one of these units. So this is sort of a major breakout. I'm not going to go for Kickstarter, I'm not going to raise money, I'm just going to chart out how this is done. So we'll put all the little pieces together. Now, there's been sort of like a 50-50 split here. 50% of the, I suppose, general internet stuff, there's been gaps in it. There's people seem to be all very authoritative, but they put out pretty dodgy code, or there's bits of information going. So that's 50% their fault. 50% has been my fault. It's like it's taken a little while for me to look a bit laterally. So initially, say when I was doing the thermocouples, the temperature measurement, I sort of was comfortable with sort of expanding and going on my my previous understanding, and it took a little while before I sort of fumbled around to find these chips. So there's 50% errors on both, and hopefully we'll get a good product out of it. So the general, I have to go back and work on the introduction again, because the introduction is a complex piece, because we're in a complex space. We're not in the we are in the sort of the hinterland of scientific reporting. So there's as we said, scientific interest in the fact that there would be scientific interest in the fact that, say, I produced a 2-nanometer wire size in my transistor, and I could get more transistors on a chip, and I'd be able to then get a chip. It's scientifically interesting because it's another point on the curve of a generalized trend of production. And one of the analysis is that even though the sort of the scientific insight is that even though there's little factors, you know, pushing individuals and rooms together, groups of engineers to do things, as a population, even though they're acting independently, there's an overall trend. So there is a scientific interest in what I'm doing, but in a much more sort of alien concept, and also in terms of the general progression. So we're trying to get to a particular position by various ways. Now, there's sort of like another trend, which is the curricula, and the people are trying to get more into away from the classical laboratory experience, where you rule up your lab book and you produce a beautiful theory, inductive theory. You actually do investigation, and so there's a big push, and things are slowly moving in that direction. So that is a scientific interest. Now, the actual introduction is actually rather complex, because you've got these different groups, the teachers, the scientists, and the students who are looking at this. Obviously, we probably have the designers and stuff like that, but you can say, if I formulate this and I leave out one of those groups, the paper doesn't make sense. So it's sort of like reverse engineering for the paper reverses to give you your introduction, and the introduction has got a certain logic, and the actual logic would flow with a flow chart or diagram saying that for teachers there's a way of, you know, their mode of operation is a continuous application and integration and copying and filling with people and dealing with a large range of people, resources. It's like it's a real world production environment, and there's a way of thinking in which they can codify things by defining beginner teachers, introduction teachers, experienced teachers and lead teachers, and all those people look at different aspects of it. They're like there's a tuning factor, and in as much that this product maps into that in a complex way. That's just the introduction, just to say we're aware of that. From the scientists, we've covered it. From the kids, which is the thing which I'm going to talk about now, is that although this is a single product, what's arranged to them is an array of products. So this is part of a family of products. It's a cube, and there's a series of cubes, and their interaction is, I suppose, basically to give advice. And there's nothing wrong with that, because this is in the development stage from a developer. And some of the advice, so the thing is that you've got a range of responses for people, different people of the class of things, and so this is a utility box. There is a quantum mechanics demonstrator box with a little Einstein oscillation pendulum inside it. Yeah, the ability to sort of rather than use the robotics and Arduino to, in this case, manage the sensors and send it off to the internet. This is using the Arduino to manage the oscillation, run the experiment for you. So you plug it in and it runs the experiment, and you're there, you're at the state there of explaining what's happening. And so essentially it's sort of using the robotics in a particular way, but they're it's of the same features in a clear box that people see through, and various things. Now, the sort of response I've had is showing off sort of the using the rector bits of the Einstein experiment to go across. So the Einstein experiment got me to the Arduino Uno, which is a sort of very cut down Arduino. Well, it's not cut down, but the Arduino Mega has got 70 outputs, whereas the Arduino Uno's got, say, about 10. You probably can get by with 10. It's just that the Mega is dropping in price all the time, and it also has sufficient space on it to have internet chips, and so it's just beating the pants off the smaller, slightly more expensive one. So, but I do have the Uno there, and part of the development is to get something and actually overpower it to drive it to fault, to destroy itself. And that sounds awful, but indeed I did do that. And so I had to know what things to... I've had to order in coils again, and because they did indeed melt down, and then that set strategies to avoid the major fault. There might be other faults in there. And with the slightly wrecked motor drivers and Arduino boards, I had a spare of them, and spare coils, and used that to build something which is just the coil, and you put a magnet in the coil and it oscillates. Now that's also in a box, so using the same concept. Now this, to show this, people sort of like to see the magnets sort of jump up and down, and to make it accessible to children, these are a very small, the grade one kindergarten children, I put a little bath duck with a magnet up it, and the duck begins to oscillate, and so there's obviously a degree more interest in that. And then when shown that, the next question is, or they look at another thing and they say, what part can move in that? So you pick up from this, so this is the development stream, so walking back a little bit, for the perhaps the introduction, then we might need a little flowchart to show development, and it flows through these channels, picking up different information. Yeah, to do it, and it's an unusual introduction, but it's an unusual thing that we're trying to actually get done. But getting back to the little kid, they said, it was obvious that they wanted to do something, and so this is the very first thing to do, is the building of a capacitive sensor. And so... that's something I've done today, so I'll sort of describe that. So a capacitive switch is basically you have a... if you charge up a capacitor with a voltage, it will... and it's got a bleed resistor, it will... discharge. And so what you can do is that you can get a metal plate and tell the Arduino charge it up to 5 volts, and then measure the voltage on it, measure the drop of it. Now if you put your finger above this and you charge it up to 5 volts, there's a large charge on that, and that will discharge, or discharge over a longer time. So you can actually see if your finger is put next to a plate by this process of charge discharge. And all that requires is 2 wires, one from the grounding wire, and obviously you've got 70 electrodes that you can go off 70 possible wires. I think that might be it, because it's not using the analog output for it. And this required 2 fairly large resistors. If you have a short resistor, it just charges so quickly the Arduino is not fast enough to pick it up. However, going from 1 megohm to 50 megohms is sufficient to do it. Now, this capacitive discharge indication and conversion to a signal is the theremone. You know, the hand is put around the theremone, and that causes it to change capacitance, its ability to store charge, a wire stores charge as if you have something up with it, which can also act as another sort of ground plate. So the assumption is that you're a ground plate. Now, I have to pick up a make-home or two make-home stuff, and so I had purchased for, I think, equivalent to $2, some 50 variable trim resistors. That is, that I could buy a trim resistor from the hardware store, the local J-Car, cost $2, or I could buy 50 of them. And so that was it. I shelled out the money because I need one there to adjust the backlight of an LCD display, and the others I bought. And this is a little message saying they're not that accurate, and in fact they're not that accurate. So 1 megohm is actually a 0.8 megohm max. So just I put two of them together, soldered them together, and soldered them to the back of the Arduino board, because the Arduino board has the motor shield on top of it. So Arduino board deals as a sort of the methodology of this to try and work out what's going on, and that's between two pins, and then there's simply a library called capacitive sensor library. You put it on, and then you say initiate the capacitive sensor to these two pins, and then zero that or check it out, and then the next command is read me a number from this, and the number essentially, as you are away from it, drops to zero, or sort of 0 and 10. But if I say if it goes above 200, do this. I have myself a capacitive switch, and indeed with a little bit of wire and a little bit of glue and a little fold of aluminium foil, just the size of your fingernail, that's posted inside the box, so there's no external wires, no external switches, and there's a sort of no assumption there. The little kid was able to see it and see the duck move, and the various things move, and the magnet used to flip around, and so there's certain things I have to do to the magnet. I have to paint one side of the magnet so they can see what's north and what's south, and that flips around, and that's quite an eerie thing. Now, taking this apart allowed me to see a pin which I'd soldered across each other, making the board less reliable, so I was able to make the board a bit more reliable, because I've got the sort of the momentary on and off to stop this sort of overheating, I've sort of limited it to 10 minutes use. I've removed that. I didn't actually remove it right away. I got it up and running, and then after 10 minutes it wouldn't work, and I was scratching my head, you know, why is that? Because I had thought I'd removed it, but I hadn't actually removed it in that version of the Arduino, and that means tomorrow, unfortunately, I have to go and back up all these things, probably email some of these things off site, so I've got copies of them. So it's stored inside the board. I've got the basic motor driver, which reverses the field, and I have this capacitive switch. And so for a switch, you can build a switch for no money whatsoever, and it doesn't compromise, so people can go across, and then again you're teaching, you know, what a capacitor is. It's beautiful, beautiful teaching. So and this interaction, then the person said, so I dropped on the way, dropping off my daughter to soccer, so I dropped in, and the kid said, can it play music? I want it to play music. And so we'll just talk about the next next phase. So to play music, you put pin out a something called a passive buzzer. An active buzzer is like a computer alarm, it only goes one frequency. A passive buzzer, for some reason, can do different frequencies. And although there's some complicated code, you sort of get used to this. You sort of know that the internet code that you read, people go up and want to claim they've done it first, isn't there? So they have this way where they write a pulse width modulation to this Piszio, and the Piszio can actually still produce, it's a very high suborbital pitch peak, but it switches on and off at a lower frequency, and you put that lower frequency in there with the delay a microsecond, it allows you to get a fraction of a hertz, kilohertz output. So obviously if you're limited to a thousandth of a second, you can't go above that, and you can't, because it's a bit sort of grainy as you go through. So you want the actual timing has to be double that, because it switches on and switches off for periods of time. Now, that may sound great, where you just feed in times to switch on and off. However, Arduino has in its library the idea of tone. So if you say tone, switch the pin number, the frequency and the duration, it will go off and do that. Now I must admit, I don't know whether if it does that, it then has to wait on that command to do it. I don't know. I think the PLC it can't do too much. It will have to wait and do it. So with this tone stuff, you can actually give it some information, and with the Arduino code, you can have the data in an array and feed it a command where it's executing the 10th or the 12th or the 17th array number, and just increment the array number on every loop, and so you can just sort of loop it through an array and get this all done. Now this has to be interspliced with a little thing going up and down. And so the little thing going up and down has turn the field clockwise, the current clockwise, or anti-clockwise, field north and south, with that delay. So in that delay time, which is about a tenth of a second, you have to put in, instead of that delay, a tone. You know, play a tone for this. You play an atonement, an atone for that, or a pause for it. So I don't quite know how that that operates. So it's rather than the delay, is this, it's duration, is this. So it's a sort of complicated way of going across. And so I'll consider doing that and trying to look at it. So you can obviously see with LabVIEW, you wouldn't have to worry. You'd get one process off running, and then you can run off as many processes in parallel as you like. In LabVIEW, they'll go asynchronously together. So in LabVIEW, there'd be no problem. You could tell one loop to flip it at an arbitrary rate, and another one would just do it. But because there's only one process line, one core in this, you have to integrate it. It can be integrated. So the idea is that it would play a tune. Now, this is sort of a little bit reminiscent, because my father is the inventor of computer music. However, a purist says, oh, look, all he did was program the computer to do a sequencer, a computerized sequencer, and the sequencer actually gave it to a device that's played the music. So it's not generally computer music. It's a bit like a MIDI player, which we'll accept it. However, there is this sort of historic precedent. Nothing to do with the world in general, but this is sort of a family one, that when you get your... So I have, in my robot factory to celebrate 50 years of computer music from my father's invention, I got the industrial robot to grab a xylophone to play the original music, but with the xylophone and we didn't have the cymbals. The cymbals arrived after the minister to show it. So there's a very much a thing to do there, and there's the duck in there, and I think it would be appropriate if I got my cousin, cousin, who's a... how old I am, she's retired, but to compose music for this. So there's sort of significance built in, because a lot of people, it's hard to say. So kids are delighted by it. The scientists and technical people are amazed by it, and the people who are, I suppose, a bit threatened by it are dismissive. You know, it's rubbish, it can be done, the Chinese can do so much better, the Americans do so much better, you know, just go away. You wouldn't explain to them that you've got someone to compose music for it. So this is a little bit involved, because I have to think about how you solve it. But the great thing is that the duck will have to dance in time to the music, because its oscillation is there. I suppose that comes up sort of looking down the track to this is again a sequencing of music to a buzzer. It's not really computer music, it's computer orchestrated music. So you're thinking, about that. So what could you do better? So toys and various things obviously have a chip, and you can record something on a chip, and just looking at it, going through, you can buy toy chips, which you can trigger. Sort of be nice if there was a toy duck and you could get it to go quack, 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 just automatically. Then there's chips which take a microphone in and drive a speaker. I think it's two for $12. Or for, I think, $8, you can buy a SparkFun Arduino-compatible chip, where you plug in the speakers, the microphone is actually built into the chip. There's a play and record button built onto this little 1-inch by 1-inch, or it's a little board there, and pins out the Arduino, so you can say something into it for 10 seconds, a whopping big 10 seconds, and then when it presses, it plays. I sort of don't like that. I've seen a cat. Nothing worse than seeing any sort of cat out at night. It's sort of like, can be up to no good whatsoever. Okay, that being said, I'm doing my walk around here. So you have this chip from SparkFun, and so that would be, you know, sitting back saying, oh, I have to spend to buy. I can buy the board from JCar, but the specification from JCar doesn't marry up. So there's two types of buzzers you can buy. You can buy a passive buzzer, which is passive and will do it, or you can buy an active buzzer, which does a pitch for a certain voltage supply. The oscillator's in it, so you can't, you know, it's sort of like, it can only sing one note. And it looks as though when they say active buzzer can play all notes, you go, oh, JK, and then going to the Chinese, you can buy the buzzers from it. But by the time you buy it and do the software, the effect is perhaps better. So or you could possibly do both. So you've got to really really think, or ideally you have students working on it. You say this is there. Now the other thing to do is to look at lighting and labeling for things. So when you say something and point something, it's good to have a label written to it. So and the label to be such that as you talk about it, it glows. Get a glowing label, which isn't ridiculous, there's electro voltage effect, and I think I saw that coming out in the 90s, and it is good, but it's expensive to drive because the electro voltage stuff is driven by 100 volts AC, very small amount of AC, but there's a whole series of things to switch it. So essentially you can only have 8 of these wires. So this is one of the things important, is that people are very sensitive to looking at wires, and the colours of wires means a lot to them. So it means that if you're doing things, you have to actually have the wires all coloured coded and stuff like that. And ideally, what I was wanting to do is go for the actual wires to show the ground, the positive wires going around, when you, at the point of demonstration, from the internet, it tells you and it glows a coloured way, so you can see the power, the plus and ground voltage go in, and the signal lines go in, and so how to do it. And there's sort of like 2 methods of doing it. One is the leaky optical fiber, and sort of that has the advantage that you basically have an LED, so you can have as many of these as you want, and just have them go around the board. Or you can have the electro, whatever it is, fiber. And again, that's what happens is that this wire's got a copper wire corona wires on the outside, which twirl around it, and it's sandwiched in between a phosphor. So the corona discharge of these very fine wires, so the very fine wires have a huge electric field. The electric field is proportional not all to the voltage, but also the radius of curvature. So these glow and discharge to the phosphor and make the phosphor glow a very beautiful beautiful colour. And just looking at it, the sort of the overhead of wiring is, adds a hell of a lot more to it. So I have this sort of generalised feeling that sort of what I'd like to do is get the optical fibre there, and essentially, you've got to get the fiber to go along these points. So I'm a little bit on the optical fiber bit because it's easier to cut and I suppose bend, and you put it round, and I don't know. It'd be nice if you could have the a system where you could actually, you know, have a wire and you colour code it. But it's, unfortunately, it only goes colour of your LED. So the sort of the LED, strangely, the LEDs take far more power than the electro, whatever it is, because the electro one is, you know, just a leaking high voltage charge, discharge, sort of glow discharge, just a spark, sort of it's like a glowing spark through this type of stuff. And that actually takes a very minimal power. LEDs take quite a bit of power to go across. So the electro lights, it's EL is the thing if you want to look it up, is this technology. Now, it was sort of like, you know, awesomely new in possibly 1990, so now it's a matured product. So that's very important. So it's just down the track, trying to get what the music is. I think I'll go for the buzzer and have the sort of speaker thing slightly separate, because you know they want music for the duck to dance to, and if it's a speaker, it's a limited amount of time. And basically, I suppose whether you could run frequency, like you can keep on adding to this, like there's one thing where it's a capacitive slider switch, so you can move your finger up and slide, yeah, get a capacitive. Now, I don't know what that is, how expensive it is, but to get the duck going different frequencies and the music going fast and the duck moving fast at different frequency would be a very good thing to do. So the EL doesn't look, you know, it looks like a bit of overhead to actually produce for a small outlay. I just really feel that the optical fibre thing is the way to go, and I'm sort of pretty used to sort of cutting up this fibre and building a unit there. It's sort of like I could have all the LEDs in one of its points and the fibre go up to particular points and snake around. That's probably going to be the best way to do it. However, the EL can actually provide something else, because you get a basic, you can buy for really no money whatsoever, $10 or something like that, a sheet of this electroluminescent thing. So it takes your, it goes 5 volts into a little mini transformer, and it takes no energy whatsoever, and it's a very flat sheet, and that really should be the dance floor for the duck underneath. You know, the tragedy is that, you know, for this you've got a huge sheet, and for it you have to block it, or you can actually cut the sheet into any shape. So I suppose that's what I'd have to wind up doing. I'd have a tendency to just black out the sheet, but I think you probably have to cut out the sheet for the effect, and place this as the dance floor for the duck to glow, and people would see, you hold it and see it. I think that's got some advantage, and this is for one small kid driving one aspect of this. So getting back to the introduction, the idea of kids asking questions directly to the designers to produce modes is one thing, but also having more than one entry level for it. So people have, if you like, a a training cube in which they recognize components, and once the components are identified, whatever it is, they can now look at the next cube and see it's through, and possibly have a thing where they actually build, you know, build some of it themselves if they want to. So it's sort of like a really an ecosystem that you have, the sort of an ecosystem of the kids and the designers and the requirements coming through. So just in summary, we've got that introduction, which I'll have to work again today. I had the returns, you know, the return soldiers meetings, taking a fair chunk of the afternoon. I don't know, exercise bikes. I did one podcast. Wanted to get some more done, and then also obviously spent part of the day learning how to do the capacitive switch, which really took nothing. So I was trying to think there's a few gaps in the code. So when you say capacitive switch, you have to give it a number. It doesn't tell you what that number is. It gets past a number. I don't quite know what that number is. I had to guess what that is. A bit of diagnostic. I suppose finding resistance of it took possibly 3/4 of an hour. And that doesn't sound a lot, but interspaced with, getting tea and doing other things like that to get it all done. And so that's the capacitive switches up, which is the sound system. Oh, I suppose that's the other thing, is researching what showing to the kid, seeing that they want the duck to dance to music, to see, oh, well, we can do that, and researching the crap code, the easy code, which is tones, whatever it is, looking at the limit of doing that, and the planning to go through that. There's that, and then so there's the sound. The lighting there. The lighting is not necessarily deploying the it in the the final circuit, but in the demonstration boxes coming up, where there's sort of interactivity, and the ability to train people in it. Now, this also supports the syllabus thing of investigation. You know, it's something that they can begin to investigate and describe and interact. And like, it was interesting to see the parent there saying, well, how does this work? What does this do? How is that a capacitor? And all that type of stuff to go through. So there's the element there, but the ability of these components, the key can see that the actual kids can actually access, particularly if you're getting a lot of them through. Like, say if you've got, I don't know, 10 for a class set, you know, at a push, you know, if you're really scraping for it, 10 for a class set, a few bugger eyes up. This is the entire thing. A lot of the sort of vertical supply chain means that by the time it gets in the field, people don't service them themselves. They just, if it doesn't work, they put it aside in the shelf and it stays there for a couple of years and it's not diagnosed. So hopefully the actual business model is different on a number of ways through. So there's that, and then the two technologies, which is the polymer optical fibre, which is sort of a key-shaped with a knob, so that you've got the main light guide, a bleeding channel, and a bulb on that bleeding channel, and that bulb in the bleeding channel is where all the light comes out. And that's got LED technology. Essentially, it's going to come out at cheaper but high power, and then the overall idea of a structured introduction, a structured development. So the scientists are going to be interested in the UB, the teachers, perhaps the UB, or different grades of teachers in the UB, where the children, or the initial feedback from it. So if I showed these 6 and 5 year olds, no, that would have to be probably six year olds, 7 year olds, this thing, you say it measures mass, they don't actually have the understanding to go through and push it across. And so what will happen tomorrow is probably putting the music in the buzzer. I've got to, for the mass measurers, I have the little servo, so I've got the one servo to go. I'll just have a method of marrying up the putting the servos, as I've been able to doctor up a plug for them, so that all servos follow each other. Probably send an email asking about load rating. I don't quite know how the Arduino goes if you if you overload it. I can see the power off for it, I've sort of got a temptation in that all of these things require power. So can I power them? The beauty of this, putting the power through the Arduino, is it manages the Earth's. If you have the power separately, your Arduino's voltage signal is different from the Earth. So perhaps it's best to, the Arduino has a power line through it. Yeah, so tomorrow, possibly the music, put the music in, and possibly improve the introduction to go through it, and possibly also set up down the track meetings with people to find your way forward. Let's say that the path for this is blocked in the education department. It's the schools, my initial contact. They've got an agenda, a plan to make it very difficult for me, which is okay. So put that aside, we can understand it. This is sort of obviously I haven't plan to actually develop this as a please let me back inside, I'm valued, although they'll think that it's just naturally following one sort of one thing at a time to go across. So I will have to look at how to go at ahead, possibly making a little YouTube of the dancing duck, so that my cousin can see it and understand that we need music, cyclic music, to go for it. I suppose the other thing is just to try and see what the Arduino would do. It's just try and pile in as many daggy things with the duck as possible. So that roughly goes on this. And the aim of this podcast, as was the last one, is, well, there might be a few people overseas interested in it. I've had this nightmare of the remote part of my site in the in a piece of software downloaded by a third party. So in hosting, you can have a you can select third party things. So I had a third party Moodle thing, and it detected malware, which I downloaded from the host, right? It probably 7 years ago, detected malware, and now we had to find it and eliminate it. And so I don't know if I've sort of nothing to do, no threat to anyone or anything like that. And I had to go in and identify it and find out, you know, how they did it, and who is protecting your website against malware, and how it got there, and how it's eliminated, and then eliminated, and then get them to scan it and clean it. And so there's probably a 24-hour period where the website wasn't up. And yeah, it's sad to say, when you it's like all things you're saying, I can't see the directory, I can't see, you know, what this is about. And and of course there's, you know, companies out there which will scan your website and stuff like that, but it really is unnecessary for this, because I'm the only one. I've got no forms, no access to their website, and the PHPs are unmodifiable. As far as that, look, I'm sure there are people out there who can hack through everything, but I don't know how you'd hack in, or how or why you'd hack into the website. So the website's just loading files, and in fact, I've got all the active intelligence stuff is sitting in LabVIEW programs rather than PHP. So I think it's very solid, and this stuff is something. I think they may have upgraded their definitions and found something from 7 years ago. So it said, these files which we downloaded for you as part of an overall Moodle package, they're not up to scratch. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I don't know what can you say. So thanks a lot, and I hope that Michael, who listens to this, will find it interesting and worthwhile, and will find keeping up with the electronics fine. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.